Fold Financial Group.
Well, it would have been, could have been worse than you would ever know.
Hour two of your Wednesday edition of Justice and Drew is underway. Senator Karen Housley joins us about 7:35 this morning. Get an update on what's going on down there at the legislature and give her a chance to talk about her elder care reform that she really led on and did is one of the very good things that got through this this session, at least so far. So very much looking forward to chatting with her.
We have a really active audience today on the phones and online. So first off, several people have reached out via Facebook to let Sam know that of where you can get those caramely waffle things.
Yeah, because earlier in the show, I asked Drew, who is going to be going through Amsterdam, probably tomorrow-ish, tonight-ish, if he could get me some of those nice caramely waffle cookie things.
Yeah, they're apparently available all over town.
Yeah.
And I said
they're available all over town. I've gotten so many messages and tweets and emails.
Pretty sure you'll have some in the lobby by the time the show's
done. Yeah, you got offers from listeners like, "I'll bring you some, Sam." You know, a lot of that's what I imagine they all say.
I do the same thing.
I'll bring you some waffles.
I will, Sam. Will you come out and greet me when I bring them?
The most recent email I got says go to Cost Plus World Market. They have them there. They have them at Target. So you need to get your own damn waffles.
But those waffles, to everyone who has been kind enough to let me know where I could get those, I really, really appreciate it. But
I still want Drew to give me some.
Yeah, but do those waffles come with the sweet satisfaction of knowing that I am inconveniencing Drew in a foreign country? I think not.
Man alive. People have also been commenting on our new Coke conversation. They're bringing back New Coke for a promotion. This is, we're in the middle of Sam's Top 5.
For Stranger Things, yes.
Yeah, for Stranger Things. And somebody messaged, Beverly messaged and said, when my brother was in the Army in the early 70s, they would clean their rifle barrels with Coke. We ended up sort of deviating from that and talking about all the various uses of sort of regular Coke and cleaning. I mentioned in NASCAR races, they'll spray down Coke in the pit stalls to provide grip for the NASCAR race cars. 651-989-5855.
Kelly in St. Paul, good morning.
Good morning. This is a controversial thing about the new Coke. I did a little cross-referencing for my own self, and when they pulled Coke off and they came out with a new Coke, that's when the industry introduced high fructose corn syrup. And then, after everybody said, spit out the new Coke, they came out with Coke Classic.
Yeah.
And that had high fructose corn syrup. And a friend of ours who is a chef saved the old Coke and did a side-by-side comparison. And he says, it does not taste the same. Now, today, go out and get yourself a Mexican Coke and compare it to the Coke that's on the shelf. They're not the same. And
That's very accurate.
During Passover, you can buy kosher Coke. And by kosher law, they cannot use corn, so no corn syrup, so they use real sugar in it. And they call it yellow cap because it's got the yellow caps on the top. It's blessed, you know, it comes from Chicago, and, it's, you know, the kosher board takes care of it, the rabbis bless it in a whole bit. And that comes out once a year in 2-liter bottles, and it's absolutely tastes like old-fashioned fountain Coke. It is beautiful. But when you're in Amsterdam, skip the caramels. Bring back some of that CBD so Sam can get the munchies for all of her admirers.
It doesn't get you high.
The stuff in Amsterdam, I bet, does.
Thank you,
yeah, the stuff in Amsterdam.
The CBD oil in Amsterdam will take you there.
All I need is just a regular old normal
There might be
CBD.
Something, too.
Hey, I got
Thank
this.
You, Kelly.
I didn't bring that gets you high.
I didn't bring you back waffles, Sam, but I did bring you back this. You may need some waffles after you enjoy it, but you know,
there's lots of things you can get in Amsterdam that you can't get here.
The soda that I always liked, and I have no idea why, was RC in a bottle. I always liked the taste of RC. I don't know if you've ever had
RC Cola.
Yeah, Yeah. I don't know why. I always enjoyed an RC, even over Coke and Pepsi. I don't drink soda for the most part anymore, but yeah.
I don't think that I've ever tried it because I look at it and just it just looks like fake soda to me.
That's really good.
No, I don't know if that's
John's right. John's
I don't know
right
if that's snobby
it's
of just, me.
And it's just very distinctly different.
And Kelly is 100% correct. Anytime you can get soda with real sugar as opposed to the high fructose corn syrup, it does taste a lot better.
Yeah, man, nature does it better.
So, did he say? Did I mishear him, or did he say that new Coke was without high fructose corn syrup?
No, when they brought back Coke Classic,
yeah. Coke Classic. Okay,
it tasted different than the original Coke before the new Coke.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Let's jump right back into Sam's top five, powered by Early Bird Electric.
Number three.
Two people were seen on camera before the Bataye-McCaska Pavilion fire, also known as Lake Calhoun.
Yeah, why are they making the commitment going the other way?
Why is this still a thing?
I'm so annoyed.
I don't even care.
Every individual media has sort of taken they put themselves in the camp of are we gonna run with Bataye-McCaska, or are we gonna still call it Calhoun, or are we gonna reference both? It's like you see different takes depending on which media you're getting your story.
And guys, it's Bataye-McCaska. Come on.
Right? From the Star Tribune. Minneapolis investigators are looking for two people seen on surveillance cameras at the Bataye-McCaska Lake Calhoun Pavilion. It's just Lake Calhoun, just people.
Bataye-Costco.
Bataye-Costco. Just before, they were seen just before it was destroyed by fire last week. The fire, which started shortly before 4 a.m. on Thursday, tore through the roof of the pavilion where the Lola on the Lake restaurant concession operated. The building was deemed unsalvageable by a structural engineer and is expected to be demolished in the near future. Two people were captured on city-owned surveillance cameras at the pavilion between 3 a.m. and 3:30 a.m. before the fire started. Images from the video show a man and woman around a table, and one shows the man leaning in front of what appears to be a sparking object at a building wall next to the recycling bin and a trash can. The photographs released also show a dark sedan leaving the area. The fire is still under investigation, though officials have ruled out lightning as its cause. The search for the two people is being treated as a criminal investigation.
Yeah, the photo of the person lighting the fire would be the dead giveaway there.
Right.
Like, oh, this wasn't lightning.
you know, guys, I think. I don't know, but I think.
Dead giveaway.
This might not have been caused by lightning.
The pavilion is on the northeast corner of the popular lake and is owned by the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board. In addition to the fire investigation, the park board's insurance company is also conducting its own investigation and assessment.
I hope they catch the people responsible.
I mean,
if this was indeed arson, and it certainly does look like it was arson, that's bad. Don't do that. It's a bad thing to do, and they should go to jail.
I'm going to don the tinfoil hat for just a second.
Oh,
did the pavilion?
Oh,
did the pavilion take a stand?
Did this pavilion?
I'm guessing no.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, circumstances in the middle of a controversy.
Yeah.
To have two people go and burn down a building in the middle of a lake with this stupid controversy.
You got one of three.
I'm leaning the same way.
One of three possible scenarios here, right? You got this was done by people who are mad that the name's being changed to Bataye-McCaska and they want it to be Stay Calhoun.
Go ahead.
Or you got people that want it to be Bataye-McCaska and want to make all of the Calhoun people look bad, so they staged this. We've seen hundreds and hundreds of times around the country with these fake hate crimes and these hoax vandalisms, things like that. Or it's just a couple of really just terrible people who are like, hey, let's go set a building on fire, and it just happened to be that one. It's one of those things.
Oh, there's a fourth option in there. No. Well, the fourth option is
aliens.
No, not aliens, but you know, how was the this is total conspiratory. This is all, I'm just no evidence of this whatsoever. I'm just throwing it out there. You know, how was this pavilion doing? Right? How many stories have you heard before where somebody's gone and done insurance fraud by burning their establishment down? I'm not suggesting there's no evidence to indicate that. I'm just saying on the table of options.
Right. If you're looking at all the possible scenarios, that is certainly one of them.
Or five aliens.
It's like or five aliens.
Dinosaurs.
Yeah. Maybe four aliens. Who knows? My beef with
Drogon.
Drogon right there. Snatched it from my mouth.
My beef with this is
Dracarys.
Like honestly.
Who's Danny?
It was Danny, for sure.
This isn't King's Landing, dude.
Could they have just burnt down the lake so that we don't have to talk about the lake anymore? I just assume, though, that there's security cameras everywhere. Like, I don't understand how anybody thinks that they can get away with anything these days. It's anywhere. There's cameras everywhere. If it's not, like, cameras that are put up by the city, then it's cameras that are put up by private businesses, or it's cameras put up by people just on their at their homes. I mean, a lot of people have those little what are they called, the little like ring things that are right by their front door where you can see your front door. There's security cameras everywhere, so it's shocking to me that anyone thinks that they can get away with anything without being caught on camera.
Which is why probably the most likely scenario is that it's just a couple of yahoos.
Yeah.
And they were probably out there and they're probably inebriated on something or other, maybe several things.
Lake water.
And they were like, well, this is building on fire. And it probably has, you know, I think the most likely scenario is that it has nothing to do with the name controversy.
Yeah.
But we'll see. I mean, hopefully they'll get caught and we'll find out.
Number four.
The Nevada Senate passed a national popular vote bill on party line votes. From Washington Times, the Nevada Senate approved Tuesday a national popular vote bill on a party line vote, sending the legislation aimed at upending the Electoral College to the governor. Assembly Bill 186, which passed the Senate on a 12-8 vote, would bring Nevada into the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, which is an agreement between participating states to cast their electoral votes for the winner of the popular vote. If signed, as expected, by Democratic Governor Steve Sisolak, or however you pronounce his name. I have no idea.
It works.
Nevada would become the 16th jurisdiction to join the compact, along with 14 states and the District of Columbia. The compact would take effect after states totaling 270 electoral votes, and with Nevada, the total would reach 195.
Cool. Good on the Nevada legislature and the governor to completely render themselves irrelevant in every future presidential election. I mean, if that was your goal, you have certainly accomplished that.
Way to go. Was not sure how that was going to go.
If you're a voter in Nevada, your vote really does not matter at all anymore.
While the effort has been billed by the organizers as bipartisan, Democrats have embraced the NPV in the aftermath of President Trump's 2016 victory, which saw the Republican win the electoral vote, but not the popular vote. Leftist groups like Common Cause, Indivisible, and Public Citizen cheered the Nevada vote. Public Citizen tweeted, "The movement to abolish the Electoral College is winning."
Oh my gosh.
The NPV would not eliminate the Electoral College, but it would render it irrelevant by requiring electors to vote for the national vote winner instead of the candidate capturing the most votes in their states. Supporters argue that it would shift the focus of presidential elections away from a handful of swing states, while critics say it would concentrate power in states like California and New York with the largest population centers.
Because it would.
Yeah. And
yep.
I continue to not be concerned about losing the Electoral College now. My fear is the long game on this, and just this continued chipping away as we go through these election cycles, because as the power shifts, the attention to it will wane or rise based off who is in power. So I think there's several cycles until this becomes an increasingly important and relevant issue. But this feels like, again, just another sort of chip out of it that direction.
No, look, I'm gonna disagree with you a little bit. This should absolutely be taken seriously because, yes, while you're correct, the Electoral College will not be abolished. I mean, that's going to take a constitutional effort. But because there are no rules governing how states assign their electoral votes, all it takes is enough states to do what Nevada's doing to essentially render the Electoral College irrelevant. It'll still exist, but because the states are going to give their electoral votes to whoever wins the popular vote. So, for example, candidate A could win Nevada by 90% to 10%. But if they don't win the national popular vote, that doesn't matter.
Right.
Nevada's electoral votes are going to go to candidate B, who only got 10% of the votes in Nevada. It's ridiculous. It's insulting, to the voters of an individual state, because it's, like I said, it renders them somewhat irrelevant. They're very irrelevant.
Number five.
Self-driving trucks are going to carry mail in the U.S. for the first time. From Bloomberg News, the United States Postal Service is going to put mail on self-driving trucks. Starting as of...
How's it
going
to get from the truck to the mailbox?
That's a good point.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, they still have to be divvied up. This is for the long haul transfers, is my understanding.
Okay. This is a picture of this truck outside a house just beeping until somebody comes out.
Come get your mail. Starting on Tuesday morning, letters and packages moving between Phoenix, Arizona, and Dallas travel on customized Peterbilt trucks run by Too Simple, an autonomous startup based in San Diego, California. There will be 5 round trips between the two cities, with the first haul leaving from Phoenix. It's the first time that the Postal Service has contracted with a provider of self-driving trucks for long-haul service.
Now, I can tell you why this is a bad idea at the moment. And the reason why it's a bad idea at the moment is because this is the U.S. Postal Service that is the first to employ these trucks and not the private delivery companies, right? The technology is still a ways off. We're getting closer, but the U.S., you know, the U.S. Postal Service, because attached to the government, they're losing billions of dollars, and I think it's maybe even here in the story. I mean, yep. They should really go and this technology isn't cheap.
Sure.
By any stretch, you're still going to need some manpower involved. And the fact that the private delivery services have not moved to embrace this technology yet tells me that somebody's getting paid out of this deal,
yeah,
courtesy of the taxpayer, to have the U.S. Postal Service be the ones to sort of spearhead this effort.
Well, as John said, they are losing billions of dollars. The Postal Service spends more than $4 billion per year on highway trucking services through outside contractors. Those costs have been rising due to a national shortage of drivers. Self-driving trucks could save hundreds of millions of dollars by eliminating human drivers and the hours of service rules that keep them from driving around the clock. For now, though, Too Simple will have a safety driver behind the wheel for the 1,000-mile trip between Phoenix and Dallas, as well as an engineer in the passenger seat monitoring the autonomous systems. So they're going to have two humans in these self-driving trucks.
And the truck's going to be a lot more expensive, too.
Yeah.
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 A lot
expensive.
More. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
This
yes.
is dumb.
Yeah. You know those two dudes aren't sleeping.
No. Yeah.
It's going to be like Ron Burgundy in the sequel when he puts the RV on cruise control and walks away from the driver's seat. No, man, I think the technology is cool, and we're getting closer, but for the U.S. Postal Service to go and spearhead this endeavor, why don't you work on trying to make what it is you're doing more efficient, so you don't keep wasting taxpayer dollars? Mm. In my opinion, you could get rid of the Postal Service at this point in time. There are plenty of entities out there, you know, in the private market that could easily pick up that slack and would gladly go and offer a cheaper option for people still sending letters.
Yeah. Yeah, to an extent. I mean, I don't know if we're quite there yet because of the, you know, there's a lot of areas that are very difficult to serve. You know what I mean? Rural areas, very remote areas, things like that. But yeah, you're probably right.
Amazon will fly a drone, you know, dump it over Sam's farm. Here comes your mail.
Well, the mail has gotten so less relevant now. I mean, over the course of a week, how many things end up in your mailbox right. that are actually relevant and Nothing. Important? And how much of the rest just goes straight to the garbage?
I get annoyed.
Like two things a week, maybe.
I get annoyed seeing the postal truck because I say, I got to go to the mailbox. There's never anything in it. There's never anything of relevancy in it, you know?
Yeah, the U.S. Post Office is basically a marketing organization right now because most of what they do is send out marketing.
Yep.
Coupons and coupon books and political mailers. And
who uses those, by the way? I get those coupon packets all the time.
Must still be a bunch of people because...
Does your household take not advantage
really.
Of those?
Okay. I mean, sometimes. Sometimes there'll be like one or two in there that we'll use, but not really.
Maybe the Costco mailer. I don't know. Most of it just ends up in the recycled thing. Bah.
Excellent job, Sam.
Hey, thanks.
Stellar top five, and thank you to Early Bird Electric.
Thank you.
All right, coming up, Russian documents reveal desire to sow racial discord and violence in the U.S. The revelations come as U.S. intelligence agencies have warned of probable Russian meddling in the 2020 election. What's astonishing in this, and we'll provide you the details, is these documents and containing proposals that were presented to these sort of agents of chaos and discord. And one of them in here, I couldn't believe what I was reading. That to the extent to which they are even proposing to try to go and cause problems.
We've lost John for the rest of the show, Sam.
Oh, boy.
I think that's it.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, they're releasing photos, images from the upcoming Star Wars film. Vanity Fair. It's a thing they do every time there's a new film.
Yeah, and Anne Leibovitz goes on location and shoots a bunch of shots. So they're not photos like directly from the film. I think they may have put some out actually along with this. They're usually these very cool shots, and if you're familiar with Anne Leibovitz, her photography is amazing. But she does this for every single Star Wars movie, and I collect all the Vanity Fairs. So I'm looking forward to getting this one.
They look pretty sweet.
Yeah, they look pretty awesome. Yeah. Her work is amazing. This is not awesome or amazing. It's downright frightening. This comes out of NBC News. So Russians who were linked to interference in the 2016 U.S. election discussed ambitious plans to stoke unrest and even violence inside the U.S. as recently as 2018, according to these documents reviewed by NBC News. We've talked about this, and we're aware of the Russian attempts to do this. And we've talked with our expert David Gartenstein Ross. The length at which this particular article points out, I hadn't even thought of before. So the documents showed this communication between a couple of associates. This Prigozhin, a Kremlin-linked oligarch indicted by Robert Mueller for previous influence operations against the U.S., laid out a new plot to manipulate and radicalize African Americans. The plans show that this Prigozhin circle has sought to exploit racial tensions well beyond Russia's social media and information efforts tied to the 2016 election. One document said that Donald Trump's election had, and I do that thing with my fingers, deepened conflicts in American society. And it suggested, if successful, the influence project would undermine the country's territorial integrity and military and economic potential.
And he's right.
Oh, yeah.
He's right. And that's why it is so important to reject a lot of these fake narratives that are out there that have become so politically convenient for the left, that support for Donald Trump equals support for white nationalism, that Donald Trump's election signals an increase or a resurgence in Nazism or neo-Nazism or white nationalism. All of these fake narratives. Okay, and that's what they are. They are absolutely fake. They are out there for a reason. They're out there to widen existing divides and radicalize people and scare people and undermine our strength as a country.
And feel free to point the finger squarely at the former Obama administration, the Department of Justice, the FBI, and the Orange Man bad anti-Trumpers for helping them sow this discord, because that's where that's coming from. So the revelations obviously are coming as the U.S. agencies are concerned about Russia's meddling into the upcoming 2020 election. Now, this is the part that I couldn't believe what I was reading. The documents contained proposals for several ways to further exacerbate racial discord in the future, including a suggestion to recruit African Americans, transport them to camps in Africa for further combat prep and training and sabotage. Those recruits would then be sent back into America to foment violence and work to establish a pan-African state in the South, particularly South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. I mean, this goes beyond your, and I think you could have an argument over the impact of these types of actions. But this certainly goes well beyond the Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Russian troll farms. I mean, they're talking about actually bringing in the human element, training them like you would, you know, terrorists.
Right. Yeah. No.
And then to come back to America exactly to cause problems.
Yes, that's exactly what they're talking about. They want to radicalize, and I mean, we're not there yet, obviously. And I don't think I don't think we'll get to that point. I think most people are fair, are rational enough to resist and reject that. But think about that as their ultimate goal. You've got Russian agents that want to create terrorist groups within the United States.
Yep.
That's terrifying.
They said there was no indication that the plan, which was light on details, was ever put into action. It does offer an example of the mindset around the Russian efforts. The blueprint was entitled Development Strategy of a Pan-American State in on U.S. Territory. Floated the idea of enlisting poor, formerly incarcerated African-Americans who have experience in organized crime groups, as well as members of radical black movements for participation in civil disobedience actions. The goal was to destabilize the internal situation in the United States. A former assistant director of counterintelligence at the FBI and NBC News contributor said that this offers a warning to the U.S., regardless of whether or not these plans are amateurish or an amateurish thought experiment. The fact that these people are talking about doing this should disturb Americans of all stripes.
Yeah, you think? Here's the problem, though. It won't disturb Americans of all stripes. There's going to be a bunch of people that are listening to this right now or are going to hear this story and go, yeah, but Trump's still awful and Nazis and white supremacy.
Yep.
And you got members of Congress that are playing right into this. You know, when Congress is holding these hearings on the rise of white nationalism, which are completely bogus and are designed only to trot people out there and you know, make some campaign points, score some political points in front of Candace Owens and others. When they do that, they're playing right into this scheme.
Right, and to that,
no, there's not a rise of white nationalism.
And to that very thing, Drew, the Mueller report. One individual involved in this Prigozhin was indicted by Mueller for funding the IRA, and the Mueller report exposed how the Russian trolls employed the associates of this individual, deliberately inflamed racial tensions by spreading false and incendiary stories to African Americans via social media. Among the objectives was to suppress the black turnout in the 2016 U.S. election. Now here's the thing, and you're right, and we talked about this yesterday. We should be coming together as a country to go and deal and to deal with this particular issue and support dealing with this particular issue of Russian meddling. Yeah, but what are we seeing up on Capitol Hill? You've got ridiculous, you know, arguments coming from the Democrats to what you were saying. Like, they're still pitching a fit over McGahn for not wanting to go and testify in front of a committee hearing when he was already interviewed by Mueller for more than 30 hours.
Yeah.
There's no reason to have McGahn hauled in front of Congress apart from their little dog and pony show while they continue to try to, you know, foment their own discord of the Mueller report because they got nothing from it.
Yep. Exactly. And anybody out there, when you hear or see somebody talk about the rise of white nationalism or the rise, how Trump has emboldened Nazis and all of this stuff in this country, you need to understand they're either ignorant, they have been lied to, or they are lying to you to try to score a political point. Well, it's only one of those two things. You see somebody out there pushing this narrative, pushing this line about Nazis and white nationalists running rampant in this country. They're either ignorant and have been lied to, or they are lying to you. It's one or the other.
And those horrible extremist groups that they keep talking about, right? They've never gone away, but they were kind of like measles. They had become increasingly irrelevant until a whole bunch of individuals on the left decided to give them a bunch of unnecessary attention and gave them every excuse to go and get in front of cameras. Their numbers have been dwindling for decades.
And they continue to dwindle. It's just they're getting covered a lot more. It's the summer of the shark phenomenon. That's exactly what it is. It's getting, every time something pops up, it gets national coverage because of the fake narrative. It's exactly like the summer of the shark. 651-989-5855 is the phone number. Coming up next, we're going to talk with Senator Karen Housley. She's going to check in with us, give us an update on how all the budget negotiations are going on at the Capitol.
But first, here on Twin Cities News Talk, it's your Minnesota Moment with Jason.
I'm 103.5.
A little bit later on this hour here on Justice and Drew, Endgame at the Minnesota legislature has many unhappy with closed process. Isn't it more like late to the game for the Star Tribune rather than Endgame? I think, yeah, man. How many guests have we? McDaniel, Dorr, Crockett, Flores, Gazelka all talked about the process and how sucky it was. Mm. My word, not
among
theirs.
Among others.
Yeah.
651-989-5855 is the phone number. Joining us now, we are very pleased to be chatting with Senator Karen Housley. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, guys.
First off, I want to congratulate you. I know you have been working on the elder care reform for a few years. It's been one of your top priority issues. Tell us a little bit about what passed this session and where it's going from here.
Yeah, we passed our elder care reform bill to protect our seniors when they're living in nursing homes or assisted living. It was 2+ years in the making and wasn't sure if we were going to get it across the finish line because you know how that last week goes. And all of a sudden it got the hearing on the floor that we wanted it to. We got agreement from all parties. And what this bill does is we were the last state in the country to license our assisted living facilities. And that was really the biggest lift to get everybody to agree on how to license it. So that's the first part of the bill and the biggest part of the bill. But I think what people can understand the most are the consumer protections that are in there. And the biggest consumer protection that I've been fighting for 2 years is the right to put a camera in your loved one's room. So now there was no law around it before. So you put one up in your parents' or loved one's room and the facility had the right to take it down, even though there was no law saying they could, but it was their own rules. So now you have the right to put the camera in the room for up to 14 days without telling the facility that it's there, even though there will be signs at the entrance to the facility that yet there may be electronic monitoring happening in this residence. So that was the biggest thing that came out of that, plus a lot of money for the reforms. It was good. It really was how government is supposed to work. We honestly didn't think this was going to get done for a couple more years. But everybody came together and spent over 500 hours sitting around a table, which they had never sat around before, to really hash out every single solitary word and to come to an agreement, which was why it was so fragile coming to the floor. If anybody decided to mess with it or offer an amendment, there was no deal. So I was protecting that little baby all the way through to the end, and to get it passed was really huge.
Do you think that not chaos, for lack of a better word, but do you think that the other budgeting negotiations provided an opportunity for maybe a better opportunity for this bill? You said you were thinking it was going to take a while, but was everything else going on? Did that present an opportunity to go and actually bring people together on this particular issue, you think?
You know, we were operating completely separate from the budget negotiations. I just didn't want to happen what happened last year, is it got wrapped up and bundled in an omnibus bill and then ultimately got vetoed by Governor Dayton. I really wanted this to go as a standalone and to get it funded separately and wrap it up in its little bow. Not that it matters in the end game. I just really wanted it to get it done. But for everybody that had worked so hard on it, it deserved its day in the sun. And it passed the night before our last day of session, and I thought it was a miracle to get it there. But when I saw what happened the next day, where the leadership and the governor took everybody's bills from each budget committee and said, "You're done at 5 o'clock. I'm going to be negotiating this," without any public input, I was so thankful for everybody involved that we got ours done.
Yeah. Let's shift. And again, congratulations. I know you've really led on this issue. It's an important issue, and I can only imagine the gratitude that you feel now that it's gotten across that finish line. So congratulations and great work. Let's shift to where things are now. What have you heard as rank and file senator, not a member of the leadership in any of these tribunals or anything that's going on? Where do things stand? What are you hearing?
Well, it's interesting because not a lot. It's still that cone of silence. And remember, I am Assistant Majority Leader, and I still don't hear anything. We're all checking Twitter, and we've got our little side text group going, "Have you heard of anything? Are we meeting? Is our committee meeting?" I just got a text this morning that Jobs Committee is meeting, and I think Education Committee is meeting too. But what I'm taking that is they've decided the bill, and now we're just going to have the meeting to let the public know what's in the bill.
Yeah.
And what I've heard is we're supposed to be on the floor on Thursday to pass all of these off. I don't know how they could possibly get it done, but that's what I'm hearing. Thursday, we're going to get every 12 bills off the floor and done.
Is this another instance, another session that is ending with deals being made by small groups of people behind closed doors, no public input, no transparency, and then rank and file, you know, for lack of a better term, legislators being told, okay, this is the deal. We expect you to vote this way on this bill and this way on this bill and this way on this bill so we can get it done.
Well, and we did have all committee time, you know, all year long to really hash these things out. It was just, yeah, the last week and a half was a little frustrating to not have any input and to even have chairs of the committee say, wait, don't take my bill. There's still some more things I want to get and to do on it. And when we didn't get our budgets until Sunday, and then to hear you've got 24 hours to wrap up your bill when you know you've got about, you know, 5 days worth of work still to do, but we couldn't do that work till we knew what the budget was. That I wish we would have had more time. So it's going to be interesting to see what comes out of these bills. And who knows if they'll have all the votes for it, because there are, I mean, I even got one person voting against my elder care bill because there was a provision they didn't like. So I hope they have the votes for all of the bills. But it was frustrating. But to get done, you know, you could be in doing public testimony for a year and still not be done. So at some point you have to give Governor Gazelka the power to just pull the trigger in the room and just live with it. But it is tough. It really, really is.
We were told at the beginning of this session it was going to be different. Governor Walz said it was going to be different. Speaker Hortman said it was going to be different. We were going to have more transparency. It wasn't going to get crammed into the end. Yet here we are, you know, with a very similar sort of end of session dynamic at play here. Turns out not being all that different at all. Is this how it's just gonna be? I mean, can we do this better as a state? Can we do this better as the state legislature?
I think we can do it better. I think that if we really agreed on targets earlier and really had a deadline for that, that's the big holdup. Is we sat that last week of session and a lot of our committees didn't even meet because we didn't have that budget target. So to get that 24 hours before we adjourn was, I think, the biggest issue. We needed to know what those targets were a week earlier. And I don't know if that was in the plan with Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan. Is that what they really wanted to do? So we really only had 24 hours so they could pull the bills in. And, you know, they literally pulled the bills away from committee chairs at 5 o'clock on Monday, last day, and brought it into a room. All of the department's commissioners were in that room, all of the Democrat staff. Governor Walz.
You can say that's fine.
We've said it.
Yeah.
I know. Whoops. And they pulled the chairs in, and you had 15 minutes between the chairs, so 7.5 minutes for our side, 7.5 for their side, with everybody sitting there to plea for the good things in your bill, and that was it. You were out the door. So I don't know if they did that by design, but we could have used, because now what's the rush? We are now going into special session Thursday. Like, let's get some public testimony or vet these bills in front of the public and take our time, because what's the rush now? We're in special session. So I really wish we would have had more time so we could have more public input on a lot of this, but I'm above my pay grade.
Talking with Senator Karen Housley, again, the author of the Elder Care and Vulnerable Adult Protection Act of 2019. And just to echo what Drew said, to repeat, congratulations on getting this landmark elder care protection approval. That's some good news out of this budget session, or this legislative session.
Our seniors deserve it. We need to take care of them and protect them. And it was the feel-good bill of the session to know that our seniors will be taken care of going forward. So thank you, guys.
Senator Housley, thank you so much for your time this morning. Great chatting with you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care.
This article from the Star Tribune about the end game of the Minnesota legislature makes me laugh. Committee chair, state agencies filled in and out of what some jokingly refer to as the tribunal room. Meanwhile, the three powerful politicians working together of Walz, Hortman, and Gazelka offered few updates during the process of what was happening inside. By all accounts, it was not the image of open democracy that was promised in January by a new crop of state leaders. You had Senator John Marty out of DFL Roseville says, I don't know if this year is worse than 2 years ago, 4 years ago, 6 years ago. I wouldn't describe it as better. It's been a disaster for the last 15 years. Marty has proposed legislation mandating that all budget conference committees and negotiations between the governor and lawmakers occur in the open. He's offered a bill on and off for decades. It has received just one informational hearing about 20 years ago.
Wow. they ain't got no time for that.
No.
They ain't got no time for that.
In February, Walz, Gazelka, and Hortman did announce the series of early deadlines for budget deliberations, including the May 6th deadline to settle an overall spending number. That deadline, of course, came and went without any agreement. Hortman said the deadline would ensure that the conference committees handling the issues like taxes, education, and health care would have open discussions about how to spend the top-line numbers the leaders had agreed on. Hortman then said when the deadlines were announced earlier this year, the whole bill drafting process will now happen in public. And the Star Tribune just points out that did not happen. No, it did. It didn't happen.
It most certainly did not happen. And, you know, I asked Senator Housley, is this just what we have to live with? But and the fact of the matter is, like, until we don't have a divided government in the state of Minnesota, until one party, hopefully not the DFL, gets, you know, the House, the Senate, and the governorship, it's... I don't expect this to change anytime soon. You know, all the talk and all the bluster about more transparency and we're not going to cram everything in at the end of the session. I'll believe it when I see it.
Well, didn't most of this happen because of the changes that they made to this legislative session? I mean, I know it's been bad before, but didn't they exacerbate the problems that already existed with this?
I don't think so.
House Majority Leader Ryan Winkler suggested the legislature might need to change its rules to enforce the earlier deadlines. We're interested in finding ways to bind both sides to more public discussion and more time to get things done.
Are you?
Without going into basically overtime like we're doing now.
I don't believe you.
Our hopefully Friday round, I don't need it, roundtable guest, Representative Nick Zerwas, said the decision-making power seems to have shifted from 201 legislators to two chairs, leadership staff, and an executive, and then one, two, or three, quite frankly, unelected commissioners in the room. Zerwas, who was on the Judiciary and Public Safety Conference Committee, says he respects the commissioners working on a bill, but is troubled that they were given so much power when not a single Minnesotan voted for them. Kurt Zellers, who we had on the show recently, who served as a GOP House Speaker from 11 to 13, said the closed-door budget talks can give leaders at the negotiating table the confidence to speak freely about where their limitations are. In negotiations, that is what that is all about. How do you find a place for everybody to not only get a couple of wins or have a couple of their priorities realized, but also realize that somebody else is also giving up something significant to them?
Mm-hmm. And look, there's a place for some negotiations when you have divided government and when you have, you know, a Senate controlled by one party, a House controlled by another, or governor, and, you know, whatever, however it ends up shaking out. There is a place for those, yes. I'm not going to sit here and say that there should never be any behind-the-scenes, closed-door negotiations. I think that's unrealistic. And it's not really pragmatic either. But we need to get away from this glut of deal making that just happened, that it gets pushed to the end of the session. We've got to try to do a better job of avoiding these types of scenarios in the future. I just don't see it happening without massive rule changes or one party rule.
Coming up on Twin Cities News Talk, Justice and Drew, the Star Tribune must have been listening to the show yesterday.
You think?
They picked up on the juveniles who were wielding metal pipes and threatening passengers at a Green Line light rail platform. We'll also let you know, in case you were concerned, apparently if you see a billboard that's advertising pizza, it is indeed not on fire.
We've got a whole slew of pizza.